Peter B. Collins, News and Comment. It's Wednesday, April 20th, for 2016.
In New York, freedom looks like too many choices. In New York, I found a friend to drown out the other voices. Voices on a cell phone, voices from home, voices of the hard cell, voices down a stairwell in New York.
U2 opens our podcast today with a song about New York, and there was no miracle for Bernie Sanders in the primary election results last night. Now, there's a lot to talk about here today to put it into context, and I was infuriated as I watched the three cable news channels. Yes, I spent time at CNN, Fox, and MSDNC last night, and they were so busy moving to coronation for both Trump and Clinton that they really gave us very little useful information. It was all talking heads advancing the talking points of those two campaigns. Deeply frustrating for those of us who want to see, you know, a real process and understand the mechanics of how it all worked. And so, for example, in the coverage I watched last night, not a single network showed the map of Bernie Sanders' victories in the state of New York. And I've got it open on my little laptop here in front of me, because what it shows is that Sanders swept the state of New York, except for the cities, Buffalo, Rochester, Syracuse, and the entire New York metro area are solidly for Hillary Clinton. But the Albany, Schenectady, Troy metro area and the rest of rural New York state all came in, every county, solidly for Bernie Sanders. Now, that doesn't change the delegate count, and I understand the vote count. There are a lot more voters in the urban areas than there are in the wide open spaces. But nobody bothered to show that map on television, at least not during the viewing that I did as I channel surfed last evening. And that's just one example. None of the networks reported about the voting irregularities, about the polling places that weren't open on time on Tuesday morning, about the places with machines that either weren't there or didn't work, about the massive complaints of people who showed up at their polling place only to find out that their registration had been changed. And these are people who were registered as Democrats, and suddenly they're listed as independents or Republicans, and that locked them out of the closed primary in New York State. And Greg Palast reports on a woman whose name is Francesca Rhiannon, and she volunteered to work at the polls in a town east of New York City. And she said that in her election district, out of only 166 Democratic voters, 39, or about 1 in, what's that, 4 into 16? 1 in 4 had to file an affidavit ballot. And, of course, those ballots weren't counted last night, and they may never be counted. Provisional ballots are a very risky proposition. Now, Greg Palast reports that in Brooklyn alone, over 125,000 names were quietly scrubbed from the voter rolls in the 5 months leading up to the primary. And he says, to put that in perspective, the number of voters purged equals about half of the number who actually got to vote. So this is a serious problem. Now, Palast asked the rhetorical question, am I saying that the machine fixed the election for Hillary Clinton? Well, he says, without further investigation, it would be irresponsible for me to pronounce judgment. Some of the purged may have moved, some may have died, but those who waited in line only to fill out affidavit ballots are unlikely to be deceased. So this is a very, very troubling situation. And when you combine the lack of coverage and attention to these voting irregularities, and the Sanders campaign is collecting information, and there, we'll get to in a moment, there appears to be a lawsuit in the making here. But lawsuits after elections don't ordinarily produce any kind of a different result. And so I will hope that people like Greg Palast will continue to investigate, but All I can tell you is that it's quite unsettling to see the problems with the vote, the way they are ignored, and then the way the television networks just moved into coronation mode. I got home at 6 o'clock Pacific, that's 9 o'clock Eastern, the moment when the polls closed in New York. I turned on the TV and immediately CNN was projecting Donald Trump the winner. Now, it was a very safe call, but what's your rush, guys? And it was only 45 minutes later that they announced with some 37% of the vote tabulated, I think it was at that point, that they were projecting Clinton the winner. Now, you may know that the official count on election night showed Hillary Clinton winning by 15.5 or 16 points. Now, first, I will note that she beat Barack Obama by 18 or 19 points in 2008. So Sanders performed a little better than Obama against Hillary Clinton on her turf. But Richard Charnin, who is a mathematics expert and a guy who monitors election returns, he grabs the exit poll information before it is tainted. And maybe you know about this, but the networks do conduct exit polls that they base their projections on. They also gather information from anecdotal information about voters, and I'll touch on some of that in a moment. And they share that anecdotal information, but they have stopped releasing on the air the results of their exit polls because they basically have stood down in presenting independent exit poll information that could conflict with the official tally. And what the networks do is they adjust their exit polls to match the official tally. And it's ridiculous because exit polling, everybody acknowledges, is one of the most accurate kinds of poll you can take. People don't lie when they're coming out of a polling place and you say, hey, who'd you vote for? And the unadjusted exit poll shows that Hillary Clinton beat Bernie Sanders by a mere 4.8 points. It's 52 to 48 when you round it off. And Richard Charnin says that the probability of an error in that calculation is 1 in 237,000. Now, I'm not a math whiz, but I can tell the difference between 16%, the official tally, and 4%, the unadjusted exit poll number. Now, the exit polls also do tell us quite a bit. The two Democrats split the male vote pretty much down the middle, 50-50. And Hillary Clinton prevailed in the female vote 63-37. And keep in mind, I'm reading to you from the unadjusted, wait a minute, I've just moved into the adjusted final exit poll numbers from CNN, so let me be clear about that. So in the adjusted numbers, 50-50 males, 63-37 in favor of Clinton for the females. Now, we know in Wisconsin, Bernie Sanders beat Hillary in women by 1 point. It was 51-49, or 51, anyway, it was 1 point right there, split down the middle. So women preferred Clinton over Sanders in New York. And also the support that Bernie gets from younger voters was present there. What I don't know is the actual numbers of young voters, but he got 65% of the 18 to 29 vote, 47% of the 30 to 44 vote. And Clinton edged into that turf because, as I recall, the 30 to 44 performed better for Sanders in previous primaries. But the real difference is in blacks and Latinos. Clinton got 75% of the black vote, 64% of the Latino vote. And those do show significant vulnerabilities for Sanders. But they also raise questions for me about why those voter groups think that Hillary Clinton will perform better for their interests than Bernie Sanders. I simply don't see the evidence for that, but voting isn't always evidence-based. Now, had independents been able to vote in the primary in New York, Sanders cleaned up with 72% of independents expressing support for him, but they weren't able to validate that in a vote. Also interesting to note that people who describe themselves as very liberal, only 56% went for Sanders. In other states, he has scored in the 60 to 75% in that category. And one more notation from this list here. 57% of Clinton voters and 43% of Sanders voters say they made up their minds just in the last week. And it's possible that the debate performance and that the swift voting that I've described, that New York Daily News interview where these quotes have been mangled and lifted out of context to paint Bernie as out of touch and unprepared, I think it had quite an impact in New York. And I also think that many people buy into the bullshit that the Clintons project about her inevitability and her mere assertion that she would be a more effective candidate in defeating Donald Trump in the fall. Two-thirds of New York voters in the exit polls gave Clinton a better chance than Sanders to beat Trump in November. And we know that the polls don't demonstrate that at all. And this shows that Clinton has been able to convince many Democratic voters that she has more experience, more knowledge, more leadership, and the challenges that Sanders has raised about her judgment seem to be tossed aside by far too many New York primary Democratic voters. And it really troubles me to see that so many people are rather uncritical of President Obama's failings. They see Clinton as the likely successor to continue Obama's policies, but Obama's got a lot of bad policies. And there are just too many people who are uncritical of that. And to me, that's one of the most painful takeaways from these election results. On the honesty and integrity issue, 80% call Sanders honest and trustworthy. 57% say that of Hillary Clinton. And this is really interesting. I've referenced my concept about swift-boating Bernie, attacking him on his strengths of being honest and trustworthy, undermining that, using the Daily News to do that. Well, despite the fact that a lot of people who voted for Hillary seem to be holding their noses, fully half of the people in the exit poll say that she ran the more unfair campaign. So they're aware that she started the attacks on Sanders that, in my view, led him to retaliate. So intellectually, they know that she was unfair, but something drove them to conclude that she was a better choice. And I'm scratching my bald head over that one, I have to say. As I mentioned, half of the voters want the next president to continue Obama's policies, and Clinton got three-quarters of those voters. And so it is interesting how really out of touch so many American voters in the Democratic Party are. Two-thirds of the respondents to the exit poll said that Wall Street hurts the U.S. economy. And Sanders won that group by 20 points in the exit poll results. But that means a lot of people who believe that Wall Street hurts the U.S. economy voted for Hillary Clinton. Unconcerned about her ties to Goldman Sachs, unconcerned about the $11 million in speaking fees from financial interests alone. Well, that's what we are seeing. And it's not that pretty. I mentioned the irregularities. There are more than 200 voters who have signed on to an emergency lawsuit saying that their voter registration was inaccurately changed or had disappeared altogether. And as we know, people had to change their registration by October 9th. But if you registered to vote as a new registrant, you had until March 25th. Now, these are really onerous obstacles to voting, and they should be changed. But the government in Albany is so corrupt and so focused on preserving its own power that I wouldn't expect that to happen anytime soon. Here's one guy, one of the complainants, Leonard Campanello, said he registered to vote as a Democrat in 2009, but recently learned from the Board of Elections that he's now listed as a Republican. And his Board of Elections sent him a copy of the party registration change form that he says he didn't fill out, but it bears an identical pixel-by-pixel copy of the electronic signature on his driver's license. So, who changed that for him? That's really, really a problem. Here's another one. Lisa Beatty, another party to the lawsuit, said in a sworn affidavit she registered to vote as a Democrat in New York in 1989, and just last week discovered that online records showed that she was no longer registered to vote. So she got purged and didn't find out about it until she showed up on Election Day. So, again, these post-election complaints rarely get any traction. And while I hope that they will pursue them, I don't expect it to change the outcome. Now, next week, there are, I think, five primaries on Tuesday. The biggest is in Pennsylvania. And Bernie Sanders is polling at a 13-point disadvantage to Hillary Clinton. And Pennsylvania has been explained to me by residents as two liberal bookends, Philadelphia and Pittsburgh, with either, you know, they use a different state every time, Mississippi or Oklahoma in the middle. And so I don't think that Sanders is going to get a lot of love out of Pennsylvania, not if he is down 13 points the week before their primary. Meanwhile, on television last night, the two top advisors to the Sanders campaign, Tad Devine and Weaver, John Weaver, I think his name is, they both gave kind of different takes on what comes next. First of all, Sanders made a statement. He kind of abruptly left Pennsylvania, left his reporter tags behind him, and flew to Burlington, Vermont, where he says he's going to take a day off to recharge, and he certainly needs to recover his voice. But he, in Burlington, he told reporters, "While I congratulate Secretary Clinton, I must say that I'm really concerned about the conduct of the voting process in New York State, and I hope that process will change in the future." Meanwhile, Jeff Weaver and Tad Devine, as I said, gave kind of different comments on what will happen next. Over at MSNBC, Weaver said the campaign will go all the way to the convention, try to convince delegates and superdelegates to join their side. And he was on there with Steve Kornacki, who showed the big map and kind of pressed him on, you know, where the votes are going to come from. And Weaver said they hope to do well in Pennsylvania, but didn't call it a must-win state. And of course, with each additional state, the margin that Sanders needs to roll up gets increasingly higher. And so we do recognize, let me put it in the first person, I do recognize that Sanders has reached a pivotal point, and it is a very steep climb from here. It's not totally impossible. And of course, if Hillary gets indicted or stumbles on the campaign trail, things could change dramatically in a short period of time. But it's Tad Devine who said the campaign will sit back and assess where we are after the next five states hold their primaries on April 26th. And Sanders is expected to return to Pennsylvania on Thursday. Meanwhile, the New York Times is advising that neither Sanders nor the guy who's running third in the Republican race, Governor John Kasich of Ohio, should be forced out of the race. Regarding Sanders, they say he has no reason to give up his fight. Sanders has always stood more for a vision than for reality, says the Times, especially with a Republican-led Congress. And this is one of those lines that is, you know, this consensus view that Sanders stands more for a vision than for reality, and then they refer to the Republican-led Congress. And Hillary Clinton will fare no better with the Republican-controlled Congress than Bernie Sanders might. But somehow, she is seen as somebody who can get things done. And they hate Hillary more than they hate Bernie, they being the Republicans who could control the House and the Senate right now. And while the Senate is somewhat fluid, The chance of getting the House back under Democratic control is quite a long shot. And when I hear these statements that, oh, Sanders, pie in the sky, free college, free this, free that, never get it through the Congress. Well, he has always been an outsider in the Congress. And yet through amendments and through brokering deals between Democrats and Republicans, Sanders has advanced a lot of his goals into legislation. The bills don't have his name on it, none of that stuff. But the truth is, he's been effective in Congress. And when I hear the Hillary bots just saying that, oh, you know, she's going to get some real common sense gun control legislation passed. By whom? When? But these are inconvenient ideas. Back to the Times editorial, Sanders' voice concerns and energized millions of young people, many of them voting for the first time. His candidacy has forced the party to go deeper on addressing issues like wealth inequality, college tuition costs, globalization, important points of distinction with Republicans. What's more, Sanders' commitment to small individual contributions has put the lie to Democrats' excuses that they, too, must play the big money game to win. So, I agree with the Times. Sanders should take it all the way to the convention. And I certainly hope he does. Every day I like to stop for a second and thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Show with your subscriptions. And yesterday I mentioned in a self-serving way that my birthday is tomorrow, and I am inviting 10 of you to step up and take out a new subscription. And Benny Alto, who's already got a subscription, he's a nice guy from Oregon, I believe, he responded by taking out a second monthly subscription. Thank you, Benny. You're very generous. I actually am talking to people who don't currently have a subscription, and that's who I'd like to sign up for a new one to spread the load a little bit. Because Gary Batterson, he kicks in $20 every month. Linda Lewis is a very solid monthly subscriber. And Timothy McKay just set up a new monthly subscription for $5. Thank you, Timothy. So I'd like you to join them. Come to peterbcollins.com. You click on the menu button, then you click on the Become a Subscriber tab, and from there you can choose $5, $10, $20 a month. And with a $50 annual subscription, and if you're a new subscriber with a mailing address in the continental U.S., I will send you one of my bonus books. You can find the titles that you get to choose from on the subscriber page at peterbcollins.com. Around the world, while we're distracted with all of our internal sideshows here in the United States, it was a deadly day in Kabul, Afghanistan, as Taliban militants stormed an Afghan security agency building with a suicide car bomb, killing 28 people. And this is just another indication of how the claims that we've made that we've trained the Afghans to protect themselves and defend their country is utter nonsense. And we remain responsible for a broken nation named Afghanistan. Meanwhile, in Syria, the violence is escalating and the ceasefire is fraying, as more than 40,000 people have had to flee the fighting near the northern city of Aleppo that has escalated in recent days because of the government forces supported by the Russians have been continuing an offensive despite the truce. The airstrikes and fighting appear to leave a fragile 6-week-old ceasefire in tatters. That truce was brokered by the U.S. and Russia, and it remains to be seen. At the so-called peace talks yesterday, the leader of the rebel groups was defiant and uncooperative and basically said, if we have to simply use rocks and bottles to take out the Assad government, we will continue in that quest. Now, Obama spoke to Vladimir Putin in a phone call Monday, a warning that Syria is starting to fray more rapidly. We are the joint sponsors of the peace process with Russia, and that's about what we have to add to that. Meanwhile, hundreds have been reported dead off the coast of Libya. As many as 500 people may have drowned after an overloaded boat sank in the Mediterranean. I think they were bound for Italy. And the crisis there continues. And since they've cut off the route through Greece and Macedonia and up into Europe that way, well, It is simply causing the pressure of the migrant population. And these don't appear to be Syrian or Iraq war refugees. These appear to be Africans who are fleeing the violence that is in some ways spawned by the United States in Africa these days. President Obama arrived in Saudi Arabia today to meet with the royal dictator, King Salman. And it is a dicey situation. The president's walking a tightrope. He just got the Saudis to accept 9 prisoners who are actually from Yemen that were released from Guantanamo last week. So Obama owes them one. The Saudis are pissed off about the deal with Iran. The Saudis are pissed off because, their war with, in supporting the rebels in Syria, including probably the Islamic State, isn't going that well. And then we have the domestic kerfuffle over the 28 pages from the original Joint Intelligence Committee's 9/11 investigation. And this has taken a new twist, which we'll get to in a moment. But before Obama left on this 6-day trip to the Middle East and Europe, he told CBS that he hoped that the confidential section of the congressional report would be released soon, though he cautioned that the information it contained might not be conclusive. Well, I have conflicting feelings about this, because I do want to see every secret document about 9/11 exposed, because I know we don't know the truth and I don't know where the truth lies. And I take Bob Graham and others at their word that there is an important link to the Saudis that would be confirmed by these 28 redacted pages. But I also take my listener Dick Atlee to heart over his theories of Israeli involvement. And so my bottom line here is the more sunshine, the more disclosure, the better. But now, because Obama is against this new bill that would allow survivors of 9/11 victims to sue Saudi Arabia for any potential liability for 9/11, we have Republicans who've decided, well, maybe since Obama's against it, I'll come out for it. And that's what Lindsey Graham did yesterday. We have hints from Mitch McConnell that he supports the law to permit a lawsuit against the Saudis. But these are all just people who are posing and posturing. Republicans certainly don't want to unearth the truth about 9/11 because it's not going to make them and Bush look good, no matter what it is. And so this becomes a pretty ugly and unpredictable situation. And it's hard to know who to support, whose motives are above board. And then we have Democrats who have helped cover this up for 15 years. Some of whom say, yeah, release the 28 pages. Others who then support the president. And it's interesting because Obama, opposes this law. And one of the reasons he says is, this is not just a bilateral issue. We have to be concerned about other countries, too. Well, the Supreme Court today upheld a judgment allowing the families of victims of the 1983 Marine barracks bombing in Beirut to collect nearly $2 billion in frozen Iranian assets that are held here in the United States. It was a 6-2 vote in favor of the more than 1,300 relatives of the 241 Marines who were killed in Beirut and victims of other attacks the courts have linked to Iran. And so if the Supreme Court says you can sue Iran, then why should we say that you can't sue Saudi Arabia? I understand the laws are complicated and there are other issues in play here. But I think it's hard for the politicians to really come across with a clear position on these issues because they're so busy scoring political points at our expense. In Michigan, the first criminal charges stemming from the Flint water crisis were filed today. 2 low-level state officials and a city employee are accused of covering up evidence of lead contamination. And this is insulting, at least as far as it goes, because the real culprit in all this is Governor Rick Snyder. And at the risk of being repetitious here, I've said these things before, It was Rick Snyder who jammed through the emergency manager law that was repealed by the voters. I believe that was in 2012. And a week or two after the voters repealed it, his Republican-controlled legislature reenacted the same damn law. And it was that that permitted the takeover of Detroit and Flint and many other cities in Michigan that were placed under the direct control of the governor's office. And he would appoint an emergency manager who could bypass the entire elected city government and operate as a czar. And so it's the man who picked the czars and gave them their marching orders to cut costs by using Flint River water instead of the untainted water from the Detroit system. And maybe the district engineer and a district supervisor and the city's utilities administrator are culpable. But until Rick Snyder is charged, I, for one, won't be satisfied. And the news is out that the Treasury Department has finally made its decision. Andrew Jackson's photo, or whatever it is, his image, will be removed from future $20 bills to be replaced by Harriet Tubman. Now, I, for one, am excited about this because I grew up in Cincinnati, the northern terminus of the so-called Underground Railroad. And Tubman is best known for her role leading the Underground Railroad, making 19 trips over the course of 10 years, helping to free more than 300 slaves. I'm glad to see this. I think that while, you know, I know that some Andrew Jackson fans may be upset about it, I think that it's an important statement for Americans. And the $20 bill is the one that comes out of ATM machines. I call them automatic 20 machines. So they are ubiquitous, and I think that it's an excellent way to honor a great woman who I think sets an example for all the rest of us. Thanks for joining me today for my news and comment. You're free to share this podcast far and wide. Put it up on Facebook, click that like button, share it around. I'm Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.